Welcome to Man Week on Radio Gorgeous. And today on the Radio Gorgeous sofa, we have the fantastic Wilfred Emanuel Jones, best known probably as the Black Farmer. Welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Well, it's great to be here. Not only is it great to be here, but it's great to be here in Man Week. So I feel it's a fantastic honor to be here amongst all you women. So thank you very much for that.
We're going to be talking about your book, Jeopardy, The Danger of Playing It Safe on the Path to Success.
Exactly.
Which you've written, I would say it's a self-help book / memoir.
Anyone who is interested in personal growth, this book is for them. And what I wanted to do was not only to give people some ideas of what they could do in terms of helping their own personal growth, but to reference what's happened in my life, because there's nothing worse than somebody giving you advice but not having the experience themselves. So I thought it was really, really important to really go through my own experience so people could perhaps identify with that.
Yeah. And you have had, you grew up in quite extreme poverty. You were part of the Windrush generation, which we can get to in a moment. But you grew up very poor outside of Birmingham. And you're 11 years old, you're on your father's allotment, and you had a dream.
Exactly. And so let me just rewind slightly a bit. I was actually born in Jamaica, and I was born in a place called Clarendon, in a little town called Frankfield. And if you went there today, you'd see quite a lot of subsistence farmers working the land. And we all know the story that in the 1950s, 60s, the Windrush generation, my parents had the opportunity to come to this country. And I think one of the things I like to remind people of is this. It's a very entrepreneurial thing to do, to leave your country of birth, to leave everything that you know behind you. So not only to improve your own life, but to improve that of your children. And, you know, when my parents came here, what they expected was very different to what they received. But the reality is that how terrible the situation was over here, it was still better than it was sort of back home. And my parents settled in one of those sort of classic inner city areas. And again, that's because it was cheap accommodation. But it's one of those sort of areas which I regard as sort of society's dustbin heap, really, because there's 11 of us in my family. So I want you to actually try and picture this. 11 of us living in just a two-up, two-down terrace house. So it was extremely cramped. Not only was it cramped, but we were really, really poor. I know what it is like to go hungry. And then watching my mother trying to feed 11 people with one chicken, you know, that was a skill in itself. And the thing I'll always remember about being brought up in that sort of environment is that you spend most of your time looking over your shoulder. And you can't really develop as an individual if all you're doing is looking over your shoulder. Because one wrong move and, you know, you'll end up the victim of something. My father had an allotment, and it was my responsibility as the oldest boy to look after this allotment. And this allotment became my oasis away from the misery that I was surrounded by. And when you're away from misery, when you're away from survival mode, that is the moment you can dream. That is when you could actually reach for the stars and think of a better world than that then exists around you. And this is really important, this bit here. And I like to tell young people this especially, that I can remember at the age of 11, I made myself a promise that one day I would like to own my own farm. I didn't know I was going to do it, but at least I had the courage to dream. And in the book, I talk a lot, the first thing you have to do is to have the courage to dream. Now, the Americans understand that. They don't have a problem about dreaming. They don't have a problem to really talk in that sense. In this country, we tend to be a lot more conservative, and the idea of dreaming and having high ambitions seems to be something that people feel a bit uncomfortable with.
There's a big difference. The Americans, definitely, they're much more entrepreneurial.
Exactly.
Just by nature, and happy to put themselves forward.
Exactly.
Whereas here, it's sort of, you're getting above your station, and especially as a black man, yeah. Ooh, the word uppity starts coming up.
Exactly.
You know? So.
And who do you think you are? You know, mm-hmm. And you're right. And so one of the great wonders of America, and I think that's one of the reasons it's done so well, is because everybody knows that it is possible to change their lives, that they don't need to become a victim of their circumstances. And if you look at American history, it actually demonstrates that, you know, wherever you're from, if you're prepared to work hard, you're prepared to work for the stars, you could achieve things. So I'd like to see a lot more of that in this country.
And you see people generally, in terms of this drive for success and reaching your goals, making your dreams become possible, is that you have to embrace the risk that takes, and that you see people in terms of those modes as survivors and outsiders. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, you see, what I think the key thing is this, is that if you want to fulfill your authentic self, you have to reach out and make a friend of uncertainty. And there's lots of different words people could use, but the fundamental thing is this, is that you have to make a friend of uncertainty. Now, we live in an age, the more sophisticated a society we live in, the more people rely on certainty. You know, we live in the age of the computer says no. And when you have all of these things that you think give you the answer, you lose a very important instinct. And that instinct is the gut. And the gut isn't something that's based on reason and logic. It is a feeling. Every great achievement we make as a society, as individuals, it doesn't involve logic and reason. It involves the gut, a principle, an idea that something can be possible. And now, we all experience in our life, and I tell you when the biggest moment when we experience in our lives, and that is when we fall in love. Now, everybody, all your listeners will know what it feels like when you fall in love. You're out of control. You don't know what's going to happen next. Reason and logic doesn't come into it. There is something that is pushing you forward. Now, I say to people this, if the last time you felt like that was years ago, there is something wrong. Mm-hmm. You are not fulfilling your potential, and that you've actually decided to live in survival mode. Because part of the human condition is that we need to challenge ourselves. That's how we evolve, by pushing the boundaries, by not settling with the status quo. And I, you know, it might be difficult for me to say this as a man, but I think we have to ask ourselves, if that's making you happy and you feel that is what, you know, that is what your destiny, fine. But if you wake up every morning and it's like, it's really tough and it's really difficult, you could change. And your circumstances is not the reason why you can't change. It's about attitude, your mental attitude. Because people do, and especially women, do some remarkable things because they have got to the stage where they are not frightened of uncertainty. Uncertainty is the killer.
Yes. And when you say survival mode, it really resonated with me in the book when people say, you know, as soon as you propose an idea, then all the naysayers come out. And like, oh, and risk assessment. Oh, well, it's very risky. It's very, you know, oh, you don't want to be doing that.
Oh, man. I tell you what, I call them the fear mongers in my book. Mm-hmm. The fear mongers are the people outside the ring. And you have to make a decision in life. Is that, do you want to be a player inside the ring, or do you want to be a commentator, sit out there and make judgments? And I say, look, it is much better to have been in the ring and had fallen than to be out there watching it. And don't listen to those outside the ring. Listen to those who've actually been in the ring or who are inside the ring. You have to decide whether you want to be or belong. You cannot fulfill your what you want in life if you want to belong. Because belonging means that you have to operate by the rules of the group, the community. To be means that you may upset some people around you. And I give you an example. Let's say you're gay and you know that your parents or people around you may have a problem with that and may be disapproving, and you may lose their love and friendship. There will come a point when you have to decide, is it important for you to belong to that group, or do you have the courage to say, this is what I am, and to be, and risk the fact that you may need to walk away? And fundamentally, we all will have to make that choice somewhere along the line, is that by wanting to be, it may mean we will have other people disapproving of it, but we will walk on by regardless.
It strikes me that you have really examined your life and noticed what it was. You've sort of debunked some of the myths of even in your own life. That,
yeah.
You know, that everybody encounters risk. We do it all the time, but we normalize it.
Yeah.
And it's where we don't do the risk.
Yeah.
Where we stop learning, where we stop dreaming, where we stop trying, that's where you've noticed in your life, you know what? What am I scared of? I know what it's like to not eat. So I also know it can change.
What I'm absolutely really interested in is personal development, personal growth. And that is a career in itself. And it's really, really hard. Because what I have managed to sort of realize about life and us as human beings is that we will tend to say, you are to blame for the way that I feel.
Mm-hmm.
And what it's really interesting for your listeners to try this as an exercise. The moment you feel something, what you're upset by something, you feel that something's wrong, rather than saying it's because of what you did or that behavior is the reason why I'm feeling this, just ask yourself this question. What is it about me? What is it about me that is making me react that way? And the moment you're able to do that, you will have a totally different perspective on life. Because not everybody reacts exactly the same to the same situation. We all react differently, and that tells us something about yourself. And that is then where you then have learning. And
but also puts you in the driving seat of your life.
Well, it puts you in the driving seat in your life. And I think that, now, to live in, let's say, in any Western society, the way you create order is to have fear. And fear that if you don't follow the rules, that if you do not, you know, go with what they say, there will be a consequence. So if you look around all our lives, whether that's TV, whether that's the media, whether that's friends giving advice, the key behind that is fear that there will be a major consequence. There is jeopardy if you do not follow these rules. And I'm saying, just if you don't accept that, if you see that as a lie, let me just give you another example.
Or a challenge.
But if you go to countries, a developing country, let's say India, for example. Now, in those countries, there is a lot of jeopardy. But, you know, when people go to those countries, they get a feeling of spirituality. They get a feeling that, you know, there's a real positive energy in these countries. And that is why, the reason why that is because those people are not frightened of uncertainty. They absorb, it's all around. They absorb uncertainty as part of what life is about. Some of the greatest things about us as human beings come from the point of vulnerability. Innovation, you have to be vulnerable. Creativity, you have to be vulnerable. Courage, you know, it's one of those things we hold up as a fantastic ideal. To be courageous means you have to walk through the path of uncertainty, vulnerability, pain, and fear.
I do want to get into your story in particular and how you did that walk yourself.
Mm.
Because you undiagnosed mm-hmm. had dyslexia. Mm-hmm. So you left school, no qualifications, went for disaster sounding year in the army.
Yes.
They didn't like you any more than you liked them.
Yeah.
And then you started working in kitchens. But then you, tell me about where the idea came from to start hectoring everyone at the BBC for
okay,
for
yeah.
Job.
Well, I think that, you know, one of the things I talk about in the book is that I do not believe your color, your gender, your background will determine whether you're successful or not. It actually does come down to your mental attitude. And I think what happened in my life is that I decided pretty early on that everything that my environment, my family were, I did not want to be like these people. And that I knew that if I wanted to change, I would have to break the anchors around me in order to move on. And a lot of people are trapped by the anchors of their background, people's sort of expectations. So that is a very, very important mental change. And I knew I had to learn, I had to adapt. And in a sense, that's freeing. So you free yourself up to learn, and you're not going in with sort of expectations of how the world should be. And then also that means you're never really frightened of trying anything new. Not only you're not frightened, but you don't see any form of limitations. So in my case, I left, you know, I as you said, I was at school and they didn't really understand dyslexia at that time. It's only 20, 30 years on, I then discovered actually I am dyslexic. And one of the great regrets that I have is that I spent the first half of my life being absolutely ashamed of it. And there's nothing worse than shame. And the energy it takes to cover up shame is just appalling. And so I do as much as I can with it, especially with people who are dyspraxic or dyslexic, to help them have the confidence that it's nothing they should be ashamed of. It's that they've got a gift that actually has helped me achieve the things that I wanted in life. But in those days, if you didn't fit into a certain format, you would seem to be a waster. And therefore, you then start to behave like that and you don't really feel good about yourself. So because I had no qualifications, I didn't have any education, I joined the army, not because I wanted to be a soldier, because I wanted to get away from home. But again, I think the great learning there is that entrepreneurial spirit, free thinking does not go with being in the army, because that's all about team working, that, you know, doing as you're told, following orders. So I have a dishonorable discharge to my name because obviously, you know, I wouldn't have been a very good soldier. And it was a good thing. And in those days, if you were a failure at everything, there was only then one option available to you or not. And believe it or not, that was catering. But the interesting thing is that I never really settled for that because of the dream that I'd lodged in the back of my mind. I always had purpose. I think one of the challenges for your listeners is to ask yourself, actually, do you have purpose? Do you know that the reason why you're doing this is to get from A to B? I would say a lot of people don't. And so even though I, you know, was managing to earn a living being a chef, I was driven to try and achieve this dream. And this is all the thing about being audacious and not being fearful, is that I can remember there used to be a very famous television documentary on making social documentaries. And I just decided I would like to go and work in television making documentaries as a producer director. Now, you can imagine all of my family and friends just thought this guy's nuts because he could hardly read. He, you know, he just basically is not the type of person that would be employed in television, wouldn't even get past the sort of application stage. But to have the audacity to dream that you could actually be better and not to be pulled down by what other people say. Most people get their reference point about who they are from other people around them. I've never, ever allowed that to happen. And then what I did is for 2.5 years, I absolutely rang everybody. I wrote to everybody. I was a real nuisance. If somebody said to me they were a cleaner, I would go in and clean with the person so I could get into the building. Anything to really to try and get that break. I can remember for 2.5 years doing everything. And then it was a woman, in fact, who invited me into BBC Pebbermill at the time, and she introduced me to a guy called Jock Gallagher. This happened 40 years ago, and I still remember this guy's name. He took me up to his office, and he talked to me for about an hour, and he said, look, you're not the sort of person we employ in television because, you know, A, you don't have the education, B, you've got a bit of an attitude problem. And he said, but
a bit angry.
And he said, but I'll take a chance. He said, I'll give you a 3 month contract and to see what happens. Now, that man having that courage gave me a massive break in television. I would never, ever have gone into television to the conventional way. I wouldn't have been able to fill in a bloody CV. So that's a very entrepreneurial thing, that person going out of their way to give me a break. And every stage of my success in life has been down to people going out of their way to say, there's something we see in this guy, we will put ourselves on the line to give him a chance. And not only put ourselves on the line, we will protect him. So that guy gave me the break, then started I started off as a runner, then went on to be a researcher, then went on to be a producer director. A lot of these famous celebrity chefs, I gave them their first break in television. So people like Gordon Ramsay, I gave him his first break. Anthony Ward Thompson, James Martin. My boss at the time knew that these were pretty tough men and that your normal Oxbridge-type producer probably wouldn't know how to manage them, whereas he knew that, you know, I was a sort of... If I had a problem with a chef, he knew that I was a sort of guy who would be quite happy to go outside to sort the problem out. And so they did. And so, you know...
You had your uses.
Yeah, I had my uses. So we all spoke the same language, which means that there was a sort of... A sort of respect between us, and that I had fantastic 15 years, as I said, traveling the world, making some fantastic programs. I've always understood that you've got to keep moving on. You've got to keep moving on. And also, you by working towards something that you want, otherwise you start working to other people's agenda. The moment you get into survival mode, you're working to someone else's agenda. And I knew that actually I wanted to achieve my dream of buying a farm. And I can remember leaving with just enough money to pay my mortgage for 3 months. 3 months, and after that I would have run out of money. Now, that is seizing jeopardy. That is walking towards uncertainty. That is getting in the ring.
That also seems to be your time span. It's like 3 months, yeah, shit or bust.
Exactly. And you've got to give yourself those, you know, those challenges. Because what tends to happen is people surround themselves with the white noise of living. You know, one of the things we probably will be talking about is my illness. And there's nothing that focuses the mind more than, you know, what is actually important. And you then realize there's a lot of stuff we sort of having our lives that are sort of irrelevant. And again, you know, I found the right guardian angels that actually saw something in me that gave me a break. And then, you know, I went on to launch brands like Lloyd Grossman Sauces, Kettle Chips, Plymouth Gin, Cobra Beer. At that time, challenger brands, very, very new to the category. But I brought something that made them challenging the status quo. That's what I like doing. I love challenging the status quo. I like to sort of push the boundaries.
And then?
And that gave me the money to buy my farm. So when I go around to schools and I talk, I say, look, you need to dream early, because it took me 30 years to get into the position to buy my farm.
But I also see, you know, why didn't you stay at the BBC? But I also see that you could see it was against all the odds that Jock Gallagher gave you that opportunity, and you did achieve exactly what you wanted to achieve. So why wouldn't you then be able to keep trying and keep going towards the dream?
That's a really good idea. But what I don't want to do, you see, is that I do not want to sort of come across as some sort of superhero. So when you use words like against the odds, people will think, oh, well, you know, that's either luck or, you know, there's something exceptional about this person. But I said, do not fall into that trap. What I did, anyone can do. It's about an attitude. So it wasn't actually against the odds. that attitude would have always got that opportunity.
And the persistence. You have to back it up.
Exactly. You so know, attitude just... and persistence.
When you were working at the BBC and you had not, did not know you were dyslexic, but you knew you would spend all night trying to write these scripts, which was incredibly difficult, no help, and as you say, covering it up with a lot of fear about being found out as a fraud. How did that change? What was the moment that changed for you?
Well, what happens is that the more successful you become, the easier it is to show your vulnerabilities. Mm. And that, if there's one great lesson I've learned in life, is that vulnerability isn't something you should be ashamed of and try and cover up. It is the most powerful indication of confidence and truth. Because you realize that as human beings, we're all going around with our baggages of insecurities, things we don't necessarily feel good about. And we inspire each other, not with our great achievements, but with our insecurities, with our vulnerabilities. That is what makes us human. And, you know, that is, as I said before, the thing that I regret, that it took me a long time to get to that point. And unfortunately, when you're young, you mask all those elements about your personality because you're in competition. And I feel really sorry for young people who think that to compete means you have to hide behind your insecurities. And the earlier you learn that it's not hiding behind your insecurities, but it's to put it out there, the easier it will be for you to be at one with yourself and also to achieve the things you want to achieve in life.
That feeling of being a fraud, that it's very isolating, and it allows doubts to come in where they shouldn't.
Well, I think that psychologists talk about, it's about shame. Mm. Mm. You know, shame is poisonous because it impacts every element of our being. And there's only one antidote to shame, and that is to put it out there. The moment it's out there, it has no power. Shame could only exist in secret. And therefore, the moment it is no longer secret, it has no power.
So tell us about the farm.
So having got the money to buy my farm, I decided that I would buy a place in the Southwest. And the reason why the Southwest is that I used to go there on holiday quite a lot. And I wanted to be as far away from London as possible. And the reason why that is because I believe that the further you get away from metropolitan centres, the more civilised and in touch with your humanity you could get. Because metropolitan environments, it's very much a survival environment. You don't look at somebody in the tube, you know, you're on the edge all the time. And your instincts of survival takes over, whereas once you get into environments where, you know, people say good morning and people are looking out for you, it actually frees the spirit. And I just like that sort of feeling that there is a less urgency about life. I bought what was an old dairy farm. It's only small, you know. In the farming circles, you know, when they've got hundreds of acres, you know, I've only got 30 acres, you know, it's sort of minuscule in comparison, but it's bigger than the allotment that I was brought up in. And, you know, it's my piece of England. And so it's very, very important to me.
And is it also important to you is that idea of your piece of rural England for which you have a real, real love and passion for?
Being an immigrant, you know, for most of the time you feel as though you're an outsider and you do not belong. There's something about owning land that is a stamp in the ground. This is my piece of England. Mm-hmm. This is where I belong. If you look at history, it's owning land is all about sort of belonging and, you know, having some sense that you know, you're here and everything. So
I would say one of the things that, you know, reparations post-slavery and post the Civil War in America was 40 acres and a mule.
Yes.
You know, that was, you've arrived.
Exactly.
You so know, this is yours now.
Yeah.
So that's part of things.
That's part of your land.
Yeah. So you started the Black Farmer, and it's also, you know, you do enjoy subverting stereotypes, playing on things.
Exactly.
Being a little in your face.
Well, again, so what I decided to do was that when I bought my farm, I sort of realized that there's a massive gap between urban and rural Britain. It's a bit like foreign countries, and that they don't really understand each other. I'm a great believer that it's outsiders who see opportunity, because everybody tends to be anchored around the status quo about, you know, how you should think, how you should behave. But an outsider challenges those. And I thought, oh, this is a real opportunity to create a food brand. And I thought, what I wanted to do was to create a food brand that was very, very British, very, very English, very British. And to be the type of Britain that I knew rather than the old-fashioned idea of Britain. So I thought, right, I'm going to create something which is a mainstream. And I thought, well, what's mainstream? Well, a sausage. I thought, well, I'm going to do a sausage and do something that was fantastic. And so I spent a long time trying to come up with a brand name, because I'm a marketeer and I know that branding is really important. And I was scratching my head thinking, well, what the hell am I going to call this brand? And then one day it came to me. All of my next door neighbors used to call me the Black Farmer. And I thought, well, you know, this is a really good brand name. Not only is it a really good brand name, but there's no one else out there that could nick the idea. And not only could they not nick the idea, but it has an edge to it. Mm-hmm. People are not too sure about whether it's politically correct or not. You know, because I'm quite conscious that, you know, when in this country especially, there's a nervousness about what is the correct language to use when you're referring to people of colour. And so therefore, people are really a bit, you know, wary about being called racist and whatever. And so to have a brand that totally is in your face, and it's the truth, I am black, I am a farmer, it's sort of that the idea that just by calling yourself the Black Farmer is a head turn, tells you where we are in terms of our society. And I know that if you're creating a brand, you have to have that head turn for people to become curious about, actually, what is that about? Actually, how many black farmers? God, is he the only black farmers? Well, you know, it just leads to question after question after the question.
Yeah, and it is, it does have that wonderful edge to it. But I think that invites conversation. And invites conversation,
yeah,
that can only be a good thing, one, for the brand,
yeah,
and two, for all of us.
Exactly. So
more points of where we can talk about things.
So what I will say is that, you know, the Black Farmer brand is more than a food brand. It challenges status quo. It challenges ideas. It really pushes our thinking.
And then, to me, it was a sort of the same experiences as the BBC. You have your plan, and now you got to show up and knock on doors and knock on doors and knock on doors and be a big pain in the ass.
Exactly.
Until somebody says, okay, I'll take your sausage.
Exactly. And that's what happened, because, you know, anybody in the food business would tell you, trying to get your products into the retailers is a nightmare. And then say, you know, this guy, black guy, not talking about a sausage, which is totally outside their orbit, they just, you know, the easiest thing is for people to say no. And so one of the things to always recognize is that it's a lot easier to say no than it is to say yes. And so when I go into a situation, I know that is what I'm going to be met by is a no. And therefore, that would be my starting place. And then, for example, how I got my products listed in the supermarkets is that all the supermarkets said no to start off with. But I knew that the only thing that these guys fear are the consumers. And the great thing about the British consumer, as the Windrush thing demonstrates, is that they're into fair play. And so I took my products around the country, did massive sampling, and I simply said to people, if you like this product, go onto my website, because I've got the names of all the buyers, their telephone numbers, ring them and write to them and simply say to them, why aren't you listing this product? And as God is my witness, that's how I got my products listed. Because again, the bigger the institution, the bigger the organization, they're not about innovation and change. They will follow the lead. And people, if you could get them on side, they could make things happen for you.
To continue your learning path, you got incredibly ill.
Yeah, well, before that, and before I got incredibly ill, I thought I'd go into politics.
Yes. What motivated you?
You know, what motivated me, I thought, look, I've had an extraordinary life. Mm-hmm. And all too often, politics are full of people who know the theory, but they haven't had the experience. And I felt that, you know, with what I had experienced in life, there is something that I could offer people as they are trying to make their way through life, because what I've been talking about is the truth of what is possible. And so I decided that my politics lean towards the right rather than the left, and because I'm down to, you know, if you could support if the individual could be supported to achieve what they need to achieve, that's a better system. But you also have a massive responsibility to society. That's where my balance lies. And so I stood to be the Conservative Party candidate in Chippenham. And I just got beat. And I think I got about 20,000 votes. And I had more people voting for me than a lot of the MPs get in total who are sitting in Parliament now. And so it was a pretty close thing. And I deliberately went for an area that was not a sort of, you know, ethnic area. It was very semi-rural. And I had a lot of people going out of their way, campaigning hard to try and get me elected. But again, the way the dynamics was working at the time, you know, we just got pipped to the post by the sort of Liberal Democrats. So that was quite an interesting experience. 5 years working away, trying to get people to support you and for those people to feel that you'd be a great representative of their community. So I did that. And then, you know, soon after that, I then got really seriously ill because people were interested in me standing again, but I got really ill with leukemia. And it was a really aggressive form of leukemia. A lot of people talk about nearly dying, but there was absolutely no exaggeration in my case. I nearly died on a number of occasions. And I can remember that the doctors, and I have to do a name check here, because there's a guy called Dr. Panos Kotaridis, who is my hero, because, you know, he worked really hard to keep me alive. And I can remember that, you know, after months and months and months, they managed to get this aggressive leukemia under control. But I can remember him saying to me, look, right, we've got the leukemia under control, but it will come back. And it will come back. And so we've got one of two options. We either give you some pills to go home and you'll be dead within 3 to 6 months. Or we do a stem cell transplant, but, you know, at your age, it might kill you. And if it doesn't kill you, you could end up with all of these complications. So it's a bit like Sophie's choice, really. One thing he did say to me is that with all the complications that will come with it, at least you've got to be alive to have the complications. So obviously I went for the stem cell transplant, and it was like going through hell. And I think I talk in this book about, you know, the closest moment in my life I ever came to giving up. And that was the greatest teacher, the power of hope. And, you know, to be at that point of utmost despair when all you have is dark clouds around you, just a tiny glimmer of hope is miraculous in terms of how it changes and brings things round, which it did in my case. And in a sense, it was that experience that made me want to write that book. You know, there's many things that I've been through in my life, which you'd have thought would have been great teachers, but even being at the point of death was the greatest teacher of, you know, hope. You know, how do you define hope? There's no reason and logic to that. And I'm a great believer that in our very sophisticated society, we should beware of relying too much on this reason and logic, that actually there is a place for hope. There's a place for faith. These things that you can't quantify are the essence in allowing us to sort of function, achieve, to be happy, to make sense of this world that we live in.
Okay, so now I'm going to talk about hope, and I'm going to make an assumption that you are pro-Brexit. And I'm going to make that assumption.
Yes,
because,
I am.
Because change and not being in survival mode and sticking with the status quo.
You've got me, yeah. You've definitely got me in one. And I tell you why. So everything about my personality would be that I'm pro-Brexit. And I tell you why. It's pretty simple. I'm not sophisticated in sort of analysing the detail of Brexit. But I'm definitely a Brexiteer. And I'll tell you why. All the great decisions that we make in life, as I've said to you before, are not based on reason and logic. They're about a principle. The principle that Martin Luther King about, I have a dream that we shall overcome. Now, I'm the type of individual that says, if I want to go left and everybody else wants to go right, I will want to go left, even if I'm on my own, and even if I'm wrong, if I'm proved to be wrong. I would much rather be proved to be wrong based on it's my decision rather than to go right with everybody else and prove to be wrong with those, because I'd be cross with myself that I didn't have the courage to go in that direction. That's one of the reasons. Now, the situation we find ourselves in this debate at Brexit at the moment is that, so we've decided to leave. We're all over the moon about, well, some of us are over the moon about leaving. And then we wake up and then we suddenly think, oh, to live this new life, we need water. And we discover the water's right next to this tribe that we want to leave. And so we go to this tribe and we say, right, you know, can we have access to your water? And they go, nah, you've decided to leave. You know, you can't. And this is what principle is about. I would much rather walk for days finding my new source of water than actually, you know, having to kowtow to those people who won't allow me to have their water, because it's down to principle.
And also, I assume you see there will be opportunity.
Exactly. And so what happens is that where one door closes, opportunity opens. And that's what we need to do. So in terms of the big debate about Brexit at the moment, it's all about, well, you know, the future, the consequences of by moving and the great alarm and the great danger. It's nonsense because, as I said, look, the only thing you can ever predict in life is that life is uncertain. So everybody's speculating on what the future will be. It's just nonsense. Change, there will definitely be change. Change doesn't equal bad. Do not think that because something existed in the past, it means it will be the same in the future. It will not. And, you know, I just believe it is much better to have the ability to decide on your own course rather than being dragged along with something you don't necessarily agree with. That's fundamentally why I'm a Brexiteer.
Fantastic. Wilfred, thank you so much. Thank you so much for being on Radio Gorgeous. And thank you for being a fabulous man week.
Yes. Thank you very much for inviting me. And if you have another one, I'd love to come back on. Thank you very much.